And we are live. Hello, everyone. My name is Josh Gilliland, one of the founding attorneys of the Legal Geeks. Thank you for joining us today for our analysis of Moon Knight Episode 2, Summon the Suit, or as we like to call it, Summon the Lawsuit. With me is Stephen and Io, and we're going to have a rip-roaring good time talking Moon Knight. So, quick impressions. Io, what would you think?
I mean, you know. What a great episode. Just great, great fight scenes. A lot of action. Really loved it.
Steven?
It was another really amazing acting performance by Oscar Isaac with the mirrors and the photography of how they captured both of the reflections and how everything was framed. It was so good. I really enjoyed it. It was really fun.
Yeah. Daring them to not nominate him for an Emmy.
Yeah.
I dare you. I saw an interview with him on Colbert. His brother was his body double.
Yeah, I heard that. Isn't that interesting?
His brother was what?
His body double. So all of the scenes where he's talking to himself and needed someone to actually talk to, it's his brother. So
I love that.
Yeah, it's
really
like
cool, right?
Yeah, so like they went to, oh golly, an Eastern European country together for filming this, and it sounded like they all had a rip-roaring good time. So good for them.
I feel like being around Oscar Isaac anytime is a rip-roaring good time.
It's he's neat.
Yeah. He's so awesome.
He seems like fun.
Yeah.
Good for him. Yeah. So let's talk about the issues that jump out. And the first one that I think of is they fire him from the museum because of the fight in the bathroom. And the jackal doesn't appear on any of the footage. So that's a problem for him. And they offer him medical care, but fire him. And that seems super problematic to me. Stephen, you're nodding. Why don't you take the first swing at this on whether or not they could do that? Because they're asking someone for a medical condition.
Well, yes. I mean, I think that they're, of course, disability law and anti-discrimination law in general is intended to kind of put people on equal footing. And especially when it comes to disability law, it's the goal is to make sure that employees are not discriminated against based on their disability. So that's why employers have an obligation to provide reasonable accommodations for employees so that they can carry out their job functions on an equal footing with their non-disabled colleagues. If you are doing something, however, in the workplace that, or if you do something that would trigger consequences to any employee, and if that policy is equally applied to everyone, then it wouldn't necessarily be unlawful to terminate someone for causing thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars worth of damage to a bathroom. It's interesting it's really clear that it's a mental disability and that it impairs his ability to kind of appreciate the wrongness of his actions. And so they do seem to want to connect him with services, but at the same time, the employer does have kind of the right and in some sense the obligation to make sure that people are safe and in their setting, and that they have a right to kind of protect their property as well. So it's a little fuzzy here. I mean, I'm not sure that he would be that would be unlawful, especially since there's no footage of him in the bathroom. Of course, there wouldn't be footage of that. And so there wouldn't be any way to prove that he had been fighting something. And even if it did, it would be invisible. It's really weird. What do you think, Io? Like,
yeah, that was my thought too. That like, what's tough is one, his mental health. Even at this point, right? Like they're offering him services, but it's not clear what for, right? They're just like, okay, something's up with you. You should talk to someone. That's sort of us being human, and the line at the end where the guy says, you know, I know this is a super HR thing to say, but like, you're not alone. I mean, that line was just great writing. It's like, well, that's the problem, isn't it? But anyway, I do think that it's, you know, the mental health condition would probably need to be known, one, by the patient, victim, probably, you know, whatever the right word is, but also the employer. And I think here, the, you know, the damage to property, it's hard to overlook, especially because they're, it's not, you know, if he said I was having a psychotic episode and that's why this happened, I think that conversation might go a little bit differently. And maybe they would say, okay, go get health, you know, go get help and then maybe come back. But in this situation, it just seems like there's not, you know, they probably are just like, here's someone who, you know, maybe he's, you know, upset about a breakup, right? Like, mm-hmm. If we imagine that situation where they think he's upset about a breakup, he planned a date with this girl and it didn't work out, he's angry, and he's angry at work because they work together, and so he's, you know, tearing up the bathroom, and they were like, yeah, you should talk to a counselor, like that, you know, for example, wouldn't be a situation where they'd say, oh, there's a disability. So I think that, you know, the destruction of property plus them not understanding the connection between his mental illness and that destruction would make it a hard case for him to win on employment discrimination based on disability.
Yeah, the monster being invisible does not help.
Yeah, it's a whole evidentiary issue.
if they got footage of at least things getting knocked down or crushed, so they could go like, okay, something's here. Because this is a world that, you know, the GRC, they would go like, okay, something bad happened.
Right.
We're going to take care of him. I could see the unpaid leave and send him off to to get help as one way to do the, we're going to try to avoid a lawsuit.
Right.
And keep everybody safe all at the same time.
Yeah.
I agree. I don't think he would win a case like this because of the holes that we have in it. Having the monster would really seal the deal.
Yeah.
We don't have that here. But we do have a storage unit that has a cot in it. And so it looks like you can take a nap in your storage unit. That's a no-no, at least in California. Like storage units are not used for habitation because there are a whole giant laundry list of laws for this is what's needed for human habitation. The storage unit doesn't cut that.
Yeah.
Or else we would have mass housing for the unhoused by converting those.
Yeah.
We don't. It's just, I've never seen a storage unit with mirrors.
It was a big storage unit. I mean, I just thought, okay, England.
Yeah, it's very deluxe, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was like a studio apartment storage unit. It was it didn't look like a garage. Like that was a little wild. Either of you have any other thoughts about you can't take a nap in the storage unit?
So one of the thoughts is like, who's even aware of what's happening, right? So does the clerk know that he comes and sleeps there? You know, and I guess the question is sort of the bit about obligation, like who's obligated to make sure that someone isn't sleeping there? Because, you know, if I got a storage unit and I used to have a storage unit fairly recently, and I'm wondering what, if anyone would even know if I were sleeping in there. And I mean, obviously I shouldn't sleep in there. And if once they find out, they would kick you out. But, you know, who's obligated to know? And if the clerks have obligation to sort of check people in and check them out at the end of the day, that kind of thing, with, you know, especially with the storage unit that nice, you're thinking someone's going to want to sleep here. Let's ensure that they don't. Because also, I mean, if someone dies in their storage unit, I imagine that they want to ensure that liability isn't on them.
Yeah. I mean, the habitability requirements strike me as just being sort of a landlord obligation. And I don't know that the storage unit facility would consider themselves a landlord to make their units habitable with running water and sewage and that sort of thing. So it strikes me that maybe this is more like a trespass situation where, of course, he has a right of entry because he someone inside of his mind has, mm-hmm. A contontract with the property owner to enter and to use the facility, sort of a limited occupation, mm-hmm. right? And so this seems like an abuse of his right of entry, where he's then sort of using it for a purpose that the landowner is not intending. Mm-hmm. So it seems like he's trespassing, even though he has sort of a limited right of entry.
Makes sense. Same reason you can't sleep at your workplace. Like, right? You're allowed, yeah, to be here during certain hours, but not beyond.
Yep, exactly.
The comedian Dana Gould has a great bit about storage units that, yeah, highly recommend the Storage Wars type shows. That it's very, very funny. I'll just leave it at that.
I'll jot that down.
Check that out.
He's a funny man.
Yeah.
Well, now in the storage unit, we have, the Mark and Steven having a debate and contract negotiations. This raises all kinds of weird issues with the different personalities of the same person trying to reach an agreement.
Yeah.
It flips contract law in so many weird ways. Io, you started making some notes here. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, one, just even before we get into the conversation between them and the contract, if you will, with Kongchu, is should Steven have access to the storage unit? I mean, he looks like Mark, but I think once he starts talking to the clerk and says, I've been to five of, these locations, I am looking for a storage unit that's maybe under Stephen Grant, maybe under Mark. I don't have a last name. I mean, the bells are going off, right? Because say, Stephen is one of a set of twins or multiples, right? And he shows up like, one, I don't think that your twin has access to your unit. And so I'm just thinking, well, on a normal day, if he had walked in and the clerk said, oh, I know it's you, let's go to your unit or whatever, like that seems to make sense. But once he started to say those things that made it clear that he had never been there and was not the rightful owner of the storage unit or the, tenant or whatever the appropriate word is, it seemed to me like the clerk should have some obligation to ensure that this is the person that should have access to this unit. So I thought that was interesting. That he said, oh, I know you, I never forget a face, unit 43, and just leads him along there, which of course tells us that, yeah, Mark definitely sleeps there. He's there all the time, to where the clerk knows him and his unit number.
Right. It makes me wonder if maybe like Mark has been bribing that clerk to let him stay there. Giving him a little something extra or something so that he first of all remembers his face, but then is sort of willing to look the other way. If there's something sketchy going on, he's like, you're good.
He's just getting delivered here. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. It's interesting though. It's really hard to know.
It shows a unrealized hole in biometric security. Stevens has the same thumbprint as Mark. This is where passwords become handy, or knowing what the key goes to.
Two-step authentication, always sign up for it.
Yeah, so
you've
there's
got an evil twin.
Evil twin, same body. To the other point around sort of this idea of, Mark's made a deal with Kongchu. Steven's got nothing to do with it, but Steven can get in the way of Mark's ability to meet those obligations. And so I don't know, what do you do with that, right? Like, you can't, and I mean, also, slavery is illegal. So Kongchu's agreement with Mark may just simply be illegal as a matter of law. His servitude, as he says, while lowering his head, it's like, something's not really right with this agreement. So that on its own, I think, matters. But even beyond that bit, right? Like, say Steven never lets Mark take over. Technically, if Mark had a job Steven doesn't have to go to that job because he's not Mark, and that employer couldn't oblige him to fly the plane or whatever it is, right? And so in that sense, it's like, yeah, on a contract basis, you kind of can't enforce a contract against the person who didn't sign the agreement, regardless of them sharing the same body. But I guess the flip side is then, why wouldn't anyone just say, oh, well, that's my other personality with the accent. And she's certainly not going to refund your money and use that as an excuse to get out of contractual obligations. Oh, my new twin with my body made the deal.
Make another note, like pretend I have a separate personality.
It gets so complicated with the issue of contract performance, frustration of purpose, and third party beneficiaries.
Right. That is
just.
And fraud, too.
Yeah.
Khonshu knew of Steven at the time of contracting with Mark.
Yeah.
That raises, okay, Steven's a third party beneficiary of this contract.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
It is really, the law is not designed for this. This is the biggest takeaway. This is not how contract. And it's like, how do you roll with that as a punch in trying to figure out, okay, so you have an agreement with an Egyptian deity after he found you as a corpse? The courts aren't made for this. Like, this is, I don't know if a judge would go like, I'm out. Like, we're we are not. No. So,
the scope of our legal system as, and also who's going to sue, right? Because Mark is the avatar for Khonshu, right? So he's acting on his behalf. Khonshu can just show up to court and blow a bunch of papers around and demand for his, contract to be enforced. So,
yeah, because I'm sure we'll see more. But if the Egyptian deities are invisible and only specific individuals can see them, they're not like Asgardians. They're on a different plane of existence. But they still have physical manifestations here. It's really, it's a little too early to say, other than it's different than an Asgardian.
Yeah.
So we'll see. I don't know if it's the same for an Olympian, but it's definitely different than an Asgardian. So moving on, we find out that Mark is married. And he's been gone for at least 3 months. Did anyone catch the amount of time that his wife hasn't seen him?
I sort of was trying to pay attention to that, and I didn't see anything in this episode. I think we're sort of leaning on episode one's comment around 3 months that she hadn't talked to him.
So there are states that have grounds for divorce being abandonment of the marriage. So this originally appeared, this research I did originally appeared in a post about the Star Wars comic where apparently Han Solo had been married, and thus it raised the issue of abandonment there. Turns out he wasn't, but let's not go down that rabbit hole. So anyway, in Texas, a court may grant divorce for an abandoned spouse if the offending spouse left the complaining spouse with the intention of abandonment, and the offending spouse remained away for at least 1 year. Case example from 1918, the facts took place in 1914. A farmer secured a divorce by abandonment of his wife after 3 years. The wife had claimed to leave him for a trip, but never returned. There were repeated attempts to save the marriage, but the farmer was unwilling to give up his farm, and the wife was unwilling to live on a farm. The court accordingly found the marriage abandoned by the wife. Another case out of New York, the husband and wife married, but the wife was a Roman Catholic and she married a Protestant. After they had a child and they had been married for 3 years, the wife refused to recognize her own marriage or have sex with her husband unless they were remarried in a Catholic service. And this is from 1960. The court found that she had abandoned marriage. And this sounds problematic today, but so it's very 1960s language. But the refusal to have marital sexual relations undermines the essential structure of marriage is a proposition basic to this court's decision in the Mizero case and is obvious as it is authoritative. Sexual relations between a man and a woman are given a socially and legally sanctioned status only when they take place in marriage, and in turn, marriage is itself distinguished from all other social relationships by the role sexual intercourse plays between the parties plays in it. This being so, it may be doubtful that a total and negotiation of what is a lawful marriage and an unlawful and every other relationship of what unmistakably and unequivocally characterizes marriage and no other relationships constitutes abandonment in the eyes of the law. So this is pre-Griswold. It is we're 60 years before the marriage equality case. So this is way old, but still good law for if you just say like, yeah, I'm done. That could be grounds for abandonment, but it's interesting to go, can you, like seeing someone just throw in the towel.
Yeah. They're like, and I'm out.
Yeah, done. It's like, well, you can't then stay in like a nebulous zone of married, but not together. And so I think that would be the fact pattern to look today.
Yeah.
Are they living together? Are they in the same bedroom? Like, are they living as husband and wife, or is it like angry roommates? Like, what have they become? Or did somebody move to a different state and lives in a different house? Like, that's, anywho, let's apply this to Mark. So I just laid out the law. Who wants to take a swing at this?
Well, it strikes me when I was watching the episode that Stephen accuses Mark of abandoning Layla, and Mark vehemently denies it. Like, he says, no, I didn't abandon her. I was protecting her. So I wonder, like, the extent to which, like, circumstantial evidence, like the mere fact that he has left is sufficient, or whether sort of credible evidence that he has not abandoned the marriage. Although she also says that he had papers set up, signed up, right, or drawn up. So that also seems to be pretty clear evidence that he may have intended to abandon or at least to divorce her at some point. It's hard to say.
Yeah, and it's tricky, right? He sends her divorce papers, but he hasn't signed it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it at least on, you know, sort of in on the side of staying married, she's also not signed them. And I'm not sure of that for a fact, but it certainly doesn't seem as though she wants out of the marriage. It seems like that is a Mark-led, you know, situation that, and I mean, I just loved when she said, I would never divorce you.
I know, it's so sweet.
I think he's rude and he's thinking like, I'm going to stay married to you. Look at you.
She's awesome.
She's pretty, pretty awesome. So like, why? No, you're going to figure that puppy out and make it work.
He's in trouble getting dates and now he's got a wife.
I know. And she's just like one illegal contract away from being a superhero herself. Like,
she's good. She's very good. You know, normally when you see somebody on a Vespa, you don't think dangerous, but
Brad.
Nope. And you know what? Maybe riding with some Victorian lady would be fine. I seemed okay to me. But it is radically complicated because if Mark had that drawn up because he's trying to protect her because he doesn't want her to end up as the avatar of Khonshu, it's the typical go away, I don't love you, like that type of, you know, trying to send the puppy away type thing.
And don't come back.
We were never meant to be. Just go. Like, Anyway, it's fun scene. And the legal just twists and turns are just weird. Because it's like, if this was, was she in the United States? Like, where? Even after he signs it, you still got to file it, and it has to become a court order. So, like, there's a couple more steps to do. So, again, it's, but I don't think he abandoned it from time.
Right.
Like, if he had been gone for over a year and they had been married in Texas, I think there's a good abandonment argument there. Now it turns out my great-great-grandmother had a marriage nullified in Texas.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so what...
That's intense.
Yeah, so try to do this the quick way. Great-great-grandpa killed a man in a gunfight after the victim accused great-great-grandpa of stealing a watermelon. So he was sentenced to hard labor because it's Texas in the 1870s, because that's what happens.
Sure.
So the wife spends all this time writing letters begging for her husband to be pardoned. The governor issues the pardon but doesn't send it. One of the senators for Texas dies, and the governor appoints himself as the next senator. So the lieutenant governor becomes the new governor, and then realizes, oh, this needs to get sent to the prison where this guy's working off hard labor. So there's time, you know, some time before that happens. So the pardon arrives, and it's a full general pardon after great-great-grandpa has escaped by a day. So he spends a decade on the run, hiding out in California, and apparently losing his mind. He ends up in an institution and all this stuff. While all this crap is happening, his wife, whose name is Minnesota, gets the marriage nullified because he's
banished.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And, yeah, so there's...
It used to be a movie.
Yeah, it is wild.
Are you then unpardoned if you escape prison before your pardon comes in the mail?
Yeah. General pardon. So the answer was yes. So they wanted, you know, the authorities wanted to arrest him for escaping, and it was like, and so there was a second trial, and it came down he was already pardoned.
He was supposed to be in prison. Yeah.
So
he hadn't escaped even.
So his life.
All the effort and bribes he made to escape is just like, dude, it's two more days.
Dude, if he had waited, it would have been okay.
That's amazing.
Great grandma remarried, had a normal life. Great grandpa then grew up and was the, first elected sheriff in Ventura County.
Oh, and that's why you're now in California.
Yeah. There we go. There's more to the story that's just weird. And
there's definitely a movie in there.
But that said, it's just because, like, just seeing, like, family history and Texas case law, it's like, well, that's... I was not expecting that today, which is also why I find the abandonment and annulment of a marriage just kept interesting questions of law, because it's like, well, I went to the Texas Supreme Court, good for her. So her son had a normal childhood without crazy dad around, so and don't kill people over a watermelon. So
that's a good rule.
Yeah, just putting it out there, make good choices. So anyway. So let's talk about the search of the apartment. Did either of you jump up when this scene happened? Did either of you kick into issue spotting mode with fruit of the poisonous tree and
exclusionary rule? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, this is why we had a Revolutionary War, because we do not approve the Star Chamber. It's why we have a Fourth Amendment.
Right.
It is cannon fodder for independence.
Yeah.
And Aya, do you want to walk us through just some of the basic parts of the Fourth Amendment on why police just can't go, hey, we're coming in?
Well, yeah, let me... Okay, so one, you know, no unreasonable searches under the 14th, not 14th, the Fourth Amendment, right? And if you don't have a warrant, you can't make a search unless they're under certain many exceptions. And so some of the exceptions include like hot pursuit, right? Like they say they saw him running out of the storage unit, you know, heard a gun go off, something like that, pursued him to the apartment. That would be a situation where a search could potentially be okay. But here, none of these exceptions are in play at the point which they're at his door asking to come in. He says no. You know, they ask him if they can come into his house, and he says no. And so consent, of course, you know, invalidates the need for a warrant. But when someone says no, and then you sort of use the already opened door to kind of walk in, we're already.
Don't mind if I do.
Already in dangerous territory, at least for those who are law-abiding, you know, members of the police. But so they get in and they're walking around. They are walking into rooms that they are not supposed to be in. And it's, you know, it's all bad at this point. But further, they, you know, this bag, I think this bag on the table is, I mean, it's a closed bag, right? And so there's, seeing if it's in the notes here, I know that there is a, you can't just, even if you have permission to be in one place, you can't now go searching further, right? Granted, if the police walks into your apartment with permission and they see a dead body, then, or they see, you know, drugs, whatever, those kinds of situations, you know, the law doesn't say that they have to look away from it because they don't have a warrant. But in this case, there's a bag, there's, you know, maybe Steven's coming or going to the gym, but they search his bag and then they find this passport, which they have no business looking in at all. And, you know, just on and on with the violations of his, you know, Fourth Amendment, right? And the going to search, the going to look in the, I think that was the bathroom where Layla had crawled out of. And the paperweight, I'm not sure what was going on with that, if that really was a paperweight or just, it seemed to me like it was an excuse to find him, you know, having committed some crime. And where did you get this paperweight from? So now he's being accused of theft. And they're really in there looking for something to say that he's done, because as of when they walked in, they have no idea they're going to run into this passport. And they certainly don't expect to run into a, you know, supposed stolen paperweight. And so everything that they're arresting him for was things that they shouldn't even have been encountering or dealing with at all. So that was just all bad.
It's just, I'm sure there had to be members of law enforcement who watched this TV show after a long day and were screaming at the TV set, no, don't, no, we don't do that. Stephen, you look bright red from excitement.
Yeah. That was also intense. Well, I was watching it, I wasn't sure, of course, whether they were actual police officers. The subtitles do say DC Kennedy,
yeah.
Fitzgerald, so they're detective constables, which is a rank of police officer in the London Metropolitan Police. So they are officers, and they do have badges, but they are also, as we see, they have the tattoos on the wrists, so they're also part of the Amit cult. So their loyalties are obviously to the to Arthur and to the Egyptian god. So they are officers, but they are using that authority to conduct criminal activity, at least to violate Stephen's constitutional rights. You know, if this was all in the U.S., of course, I'm not really sure how the U.K. protects the rights of the accused, and I'm sure they have something since the 18th century, but when the U.S. Left, yeah, because of the lack of rights of the accused in some part. So So I guess it also struck me that when people or officers are using their authority to commit crimes or to violate people's rights, federal law prohibits that. And of course, many people have heard of 42 U.S.C. 1983, which is the civil remedy that permits people to sue officers of the state or local government. It's only state or local when the officers violate people's constitutional rights. And that's the statute and the remedy for when, you know, people are experience excessive force at the hands of arresting officers, or when they are subject to an unlawful search warrant or an unlawful search. So so they could be sued under that federal statute by Stephen or Mark, I guess, whoever's rights are violated. So there's that, but then also federal law makes it a crime for officers to violate people's constitutional rights. And I was looking it up, and the statute says when kidnapping is involved, then it's like it's up to a capital offense. Like they could be sentenced to death for kidnapping Mark or Stephen under color of law. Really interesting. I hadn't realized that. So they're in a lot of trouble. They not only have violated his Fourth Amendment rights, but they've kidnapped him. Under the color of law.
And arguably, they're using their police database
for right.
unlawful purpose. So you get that, and they're dropping them off at a cult. So this is—I mean, it'd be—I'm like trying to think of a nightmare scenario that we could at least compare it. And like, imagine if law enforcement—if members of law enforcement were part of the Klan or Oath Keepers or something like that—and they were then using. they're using the position to do those horrible things. Bad. Like, we don't bad on so many levels. It's like you took an oath to uphold the law and you're now breaking it. And when you look at what Ahmed's supposedly doing, that just seems antithetical to the law enforcement for civil society. Because it's let's just have roadside executions. Yeah. That's horrid on so many levels. But it's a brilliant scene because we're all just giddy talking about it.
Yeah.
So when we get to Arthur and his creepy tour. If I saw a group of people all wearing headsets watching dolphins, I would leave.
Big cult vibe.
Yeah, like this doesn't. No, I am going home. Maybe straight to church. I'm not sure, but I'm getting the hell out of there. So there's the cult vibe. No amount of lentil soup is going to make me change my mind.
I mean, it was good soup.
I do love good soup. That's something.
It sounded tasty. And it's neat to see the, like, a civilized discussion between the antagonist and the protagonist over soup. That was fun. And getting a little bit more of the backstory that Arthur came from. But, They brilliantly brought up the point I raised last time between preventative justice and are you okay killing a kid?
Yeah.
Because Arthur's position is, well, it's like a diseased limb. You got to cut it off. And it's like, I draw the line at child murder. And it's like, good for Stephen. It's tough to sit in a group of a cult and say, I disagree with what you're doing because you want to kill children. Very reaffirming, because it's, you know, you look at like the old social experiments that were done after all the horror the Nazis did. So like it's Milgram prison, Stanford prison experiment, where good people are just willing to go along and do something horrible because they're surrounded and they're afraid for their lives, or it's just somebody in an authority position saying, turn it up to 50. And Stephen says, no, it's this is the wrong thing to do. You don't kill kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting that the moral clarity was sort of isolated in that splinter of his personality, and Mark seems to maybe didn't quite get much of that.
I don't know. I think we're going to learn more about Mark.
Yeah.
Because, you know, at least with Khonshu, the issue is, I am true justice because I go after people who have done bad things as opposed to preventative justice by somebody I will do something in the future. It's like, well, then there's a chance to change. Like, yeah. There's courts don't work forward motion to punish people. Either of what were your reactions?
Yeah. So one of the thoughts I had that, so Arthur starts off the Fist of Vengeance, right? He's Khonshu's avatar. And it makes me think of sort of once you start down the path of being the Fist of Vengeance, right? Like he's not Batman, right? He's not arresting people and dragging them to the police station and saying, here's the criminal you're looking for. He's exerting vengeance himself, like sort of this, you know, what's the word? It's just a path down, you know, it makes sense because I think that if you start it, you know, when he makes the point, which I think is a good point, that by the time that your post, you know, crime justice happens, suffering has already happened, right? And so I think that that's a valid point. The problem is that then going and, you know, killing people based on things that they will do in the future, not okay. But I think once you start off being the person who's exerting justice, you start to think, man, what if I could do justice before the harm is done? To me, it's actually a logical path for a person who starts off being a vigilante to then say, you know what, when I do my vigilantism, I'm, you know, bringing revenge, but the things already happened. It sure would be nice to go just a little step further and get to the pre-crime punishment. And I think that made me think, like, one, that's a reason for Steven to not end up being an avatar for Khonshu, because it probably rots your brain and your moral core a little bit to be the one who's out here killing people, because at some point you might very well think, you know what, I'd sure like to prevent pain and, you know, take on this noble, I mean, he talks about that neighborhood, how it used to be crime riddled and now everything's good. And it's like, yeah, because you murdered people that you thought would someday do something bad. That was one of like my primary thoughts on it. But overall, for sure, not okay to kill babies. And, you know, this, the taste, the difference between medicine and poison is just a matter of dosage. I'm like, you're saying all of this like it's okay. It is not okay.
Yeah, it's again, like Daredevil, sure, there's a lot of spinal injuries, but his goal is not to kill people and kind of law enforcement. I mean, so there's at least a parallel there, but this is pre-revenge doesn't work. It's not justice. And for the, you know, the part of town that was dangerous, it's like, well, this is why education's important. This is why jobs are important. This is why you raise people up out of property, of poverty, not let's go on a killing spree.
Right.
It's just,
ignore all of the things that make those people become, you know, criminals.
Yeah, it's just, maybe we could try helping. Just,
yeah. It's like, no, murder. Murder's the answer. Just is. I love when Steven looks out to everyone and says, wait, are you all right with this? It's like, oh, y'all are nuts. It's not, it's, and just that, like that sort of like loneliness of that moment of looking out and realizing, oh, because, you know, Arthur is thinking he can talk some sense into Steven, or, and then eventually, well, like if Steven's not going to make sense, maybe Mark. It's like, no, dude. Not talking to Mark, and Steven's not on the same page with you, buddy.
You know, and clearly Mark's not as well. So it's like, nope, we don't do that here. Steven, your thoughts on, the abandonment of the law as we know it.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting in the context of the MCU, too, because we know from Loki and the TVA, that there are powers in the universe that can kind of see the future. And there might be sort of a cosmic entity who is so confident that there is no way that this person is never going to be good, or it's inevitable that they're going to do this, that they might think that was justified. But I think the whole point of Loki was that there's always a choice, and you can always bend the timeline, and you can always work for different outcomes. So I think I was trying to kind of get my head around how that all works in the cosmology of the MCU.
That's very thoughtful. I thought in terms of Daredevil. I like the way that you thought of Loki. I mean, heck, even the Punisher has a moral code. Mm-hmm. And this would break the Punisher's moral code.
That's because
it's like, nope, not doing that. Like there has to be wrongdoing already.
Yeah.
For the Punisher to start killing people.
Yeah.
This is, it's just perverse. It's ethnic cleansing. It's just.
There's a movie called, I think it's Looper.
Yeah.
With Joseph Gordon-Levitt. And this is, that's the scenario, right? Is this kid who's going to grow up to be this, big bad of the big bad. And he's, attempting, I think the whole story is like trying to get there to kill him. But then at the end sort of realizes that actually the thing that turns him into, big evil is the death of his mother. And so if you can just stop the death of the mother, then you course correct. And of course, you hope, right? And that's sort of what it means to be human, right? Like that's the entire MCU is, and DC universes, right? It's like the idea of humanity is this thing where you get to choose and you have to believe that people will be better if they have better choices and better options, and not just sort of out as soon as possible. Because at some point then it's too easy, right? Like it becomes too easy to say someday down the line, you're going to be really stressed out about trying to get to the airport on time. And you might drive so fast that you cause a car accident and a pregnant woman dies. And so for that reason, it will kill you as a baby. And it's like, wait, what? What if I just become a better person about time? Like that seems like a better way to do it.
I mean, it also goes against the message of Deadpool 2, that, the kid becomes a
threat. Yeah.
It's like, maybe if those bad things didn't happen to him, he would not go down the dark path and would learn to be good. It's appropriate that we're coming up on Easter, because the idea of atonement and making good choices and forgiveness and going like, wow, I did something bad, I should do correct.
Yeah.
This Ahmet goes against all of that.
Yeah.
And we see that Arthur's willing to just kill a dude who found the scarab. That's murder. There's like no justifiable reason to kill that man. And he does. Because he found it. So it's dark and weird.
Yeah. Like, why did he? I mean, and this is why I think, Arthur's soul is rotten, because there is no reason, right? Like, he's got the man didn't fight him for it. He gave it to him and said, I would give, it's sort of like Arthur says things so that he hears himself saying the right things, but then doesn't actually care. Because he's like, well, I could give you food and, shelter, but not this, takes it and then takes the man, takes the man's life for no reason. And, what is he scared? Someone's going to find out that he has it. Like, obviously, Khonshu knows that, he's got it. So it's not like I'm going to keep him from telling everyone that he found the scarab and gave it to me. It doesn't matter at this point. But yeah, I think his, all the murdering he's been doing for Khonshu has rotted his soul. And now he's, just a really bad guy.
Yeah, and I still think it remains to be seen what Khonshu had him do, or because that still gets into personal choice.
Yeah.
like, how did he fall for Amit? Like, what's the thought process there? And if it's the, it's like the issue with prosecutors who remain in the job too long. This isn't globally all prosecutors, but a lot of them historically start seeing everyone as scum.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Everyone's bad. Are we in that type of category with him? Because he's talking like the fun pastor who just wants to help people. And then there's a hard turn when he murders them.
Yeah.
That's really weird. It's just because he seems to be, I'm into peace. I want everyone happy and fed. And I want to make heaven on earth. We just have to kill a lot of people to do it. And like, that's the evil cult coming out with like, you believe it. And you're willing to butcher people for that. So it's, you know, there's no amount of lentil soup that's going to make that okay.
No matter how good it is.
No, no. Even though it does sound really tasty for dinner. But, Stephen, you noted the, you know, we have the Mark Khonshu contract enforceability issue. Could you walk us through that?
Yeah, I think that sort of more will come to light about what circumstances there are there. But the exchange at the very end of the episode between Khonshu and Mark, it sounds like Khonshu found Mark's body, worked some Egyptian god mojo, brought Mark back to life, and Mark told Stephen that the price they pay for that being saved is that they're now servants of servitude, use the word, of Khonshu. And so there's a couple things wrong with that contract. It certainly wouldn't be enforceable, first of all, because the contract is for sort of servitude, which is certainly unlawful in the U.S. Also, contracts that have for their purpose an illegal end, like murdering people, is certainly not an enforceable contract. So Mark could certainly just walk away from that as far as the US law is concerned. But at the same time, every contract is sort of more fundamentally requires offer acceptance and consideration of both parties. Both parties have to have skin in the game. And the consideration cannot be past or a moral obligation. So the classic example is like if you are walking down the street and you see someone trip and fall and hurt themselves, and you help them and get them to medical attention, if that person says, oh, I'm really grateful for the help, I want to give you some money, that the person who rendered the aid cannot enforce that contract or that offer because the consideration or what the skin they put in that game was the past. It was something they did sort of gratuitously. So Khonshu can't say, I raised you from the dead, now you owe me. He could never enforce that kind of a contract in the U.S. court. So there's so many things wrong with that on a sort of a legal level, but it remains to be seen what kind of leverage they have.
Well, there's also the duress factor with, if you don't do this, I'm going to make your wife do it.
Right. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, it's like, whoa, like that's... Yeah,
that's not
I keep wanting to say, let my people go. It just, again... The good Lutheran in me is like, I am super uncomfortable with these Egyptian deities. Like, this is not. No. Good analysis there.
It sort of remains to be seen. Like, we'll see, like, what their backstory is. And I wonder how Arthur got out of his contract, too. And how we got bound to him in the first place.
And what's the timing on that?
Yeah.
Because was there another supernatural intervening force that caused frustration of contract in order to get Arthur out?
Right.
And that's just, oh boy, when you're playing with deities and avatars, it gets really complicated because it's like the law's not designed for this because it goes against public policy. It'd be one thing if this was kind of like a quantum leap thing, like, or again, like New Testament's like, okay, I raised you from the dead and I want you to go around and feed the homeless. Okay. Like that's a good thing. Like that seems like something we can all get on board with. Like, oh, you go around helping people like Sam and Al. cool. But when it's, I want you to go kill some people, that, oh boy, it's like, it's not okay.
And I mean, the dead archaeologists, right? Is that, I mean, like they're, at least we believe, right? Like, I don't think we get any argument from Mark at any point that that didn't happen. So is there this folk, or I guess it may have been Arthur's people that killed them. Is that what you're thinking?
I'm thinking Mark was killed with them.
Ah, right.
So I don't think Mark, I think Mark was a victim that was raised from the dead.
Yeah, that would make sense. Yeah, because I'm just like, okay, so is Mark, are Mark's hands, you know, is he hurting, or is he hurting people who have done bad things, or is he hurting people to get at, you know, some other bigger goal? But I think that makes a, that would make a lot of sense if Arthur's people, I mean, they're the ones after the scarab and Mark's trying to keep him away from it. So,
because he does, it's, this is the world that had, you know, the Battle of New York. Ultron tried to create genocide. Thanos, there's a bunch of stuff in between. So everyone's probably a little on the sensitive side about like who wants to do what.
Yeah.
And this is why we have Avengers. If there's some vengeful god that's going to rise from a tomb and start murdering people, this is where you call in the big guns to save the day.
And we'll put a pin in the whole Khonshu versus Amit lawsuit for tortious interference of contract for stealing away. Maybe in a future episode.
I think the issue there, let's everyone buckle up. So.
Oh man, I love it.
This is how we have fun. So.
Fun stuff. Did you guys see, this is just a little outside of the legal stuff, but did you guys see the, like, I've seen tweets around like people zooming in on Mark's passport and saying that he must have gotten his passport during the blip, so he must not have been blipped. Passport, like the issue date. I was like, well, first of all, I mean, I love the internet and just how people know that, but yeah, like they zoomed into, you know, because they opened the passport data page to us. They're like, yeah, he got his passport, I think September 2018, which would have been after the blip, which means he was around getting a passport and not, you know, in blip land.
I thought he survived just from, it's like he's been act. It looked like he'd been
active. Yeah.
And so it's not like Yelena who, you know.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so
that was my read of it. But granted, I didn't dig into the passport.
Yeah, anymore. I was like, oh, this is, you know, fun, fun little thing.
I agree with the analysis, but I arrived at that just on my own with, he seems to have been active for 5 years. Right.
Very recently, yeah.
Yeah, he didn't wake up in 2023 going like, what happened? Like, because that's a rough morning.
Poor Yelena.
Who's in my apartment like that? Where's my stuff? or again, it, you know, it looked like from either San Francisco or Alameda, because Ant-Man's supposed to be in San Francisco, but it looks like it's more like an Alameda neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
But like it's with trash out, abandoned cars. If your house is abandoned and you disappear and then come back and go like, what the hell happened?
Yeah.
Like, why is everything dusty and rotten and boarded up?
Who are these people living in my house?
Right.
Like, who are these squatters who are suddenly here?
I think he survived. Yeah. And London seems to be functioning pretty well post-blip. Captain America and Winter Soldier aside. And yes, I mean Cap, not Falcon. Cap.
Yep.
Good times. This is a fun show.
Yeah. And to agree. I'm excited. I love Layla. I hope we get more of her. I noted how she like comes back to, like when she comes to the cult house, she starts calling him Steven, but then she's like, Mark, summon the suit, and he, I don't know. And how just she could handle herself. Like that's.
Yep.
That's somebody I would not want to sign divorce papers with. We're going to call that a good team and make it work.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry for whatever I did, and I will do better. So
she's not going to be running around killing people for kung shu. So, well, although I don't know that a divorce keeps that from happening. That's and that's sort of the thing with the go away, I don't love you, so I can protect you thing. It's like, okay. Things are still going to happen to Gwen, even if Spider-Man's not with her. Like,
yep.
We know he loves her. Like, that's just kind of a thing.
You make it work. I mean, and on that you make it work note, I really hope that Toby's version of Spider-Man ended up with Mary Jane and that they have a little May Parker now. Would have been a nice Easter egg if they had, you know, if he had tossed that out with, like, yeah, we have a daughter named May. That would have been, but again, they came close to punting the football a bunch of times in that movie, and they repressed the desire to go that far. But it's like, life is hard. Having a relationship or a spouse is hard. You know, the vow is in sickness and health, for better or for worse. Yeah. And like, it's hard to think of an Egyptian deity wanting to use your servitude to like murder people, but.
It's part of the deal.
You're gonna make it work. Like, I don't know how you explain that to your spouse, but
well, at least he's got a spouse that I mean and again, we don't know how much Layla knows at this point, but she's out here fighting with him. She's gotta know about Kung Chu and all of that. Maybe just not the fact that she may have to be the avatar and what the process is to obliging her to it. So, maybe Khonshu is out here actually planning your murder so he can raise you back up and then save you. I can see that.
Yeah, it's, again, when deities are playing God, it's not good.
Yeah.
Anywho, I do love this. We're going to find another day to record live next week because we're not going to do this on Easter because, well, crazy. We have families. We'll find another day besides Easter.
No problem.
Yeah, that all sounds good.
Excellent. Great. Well, everyone, thank you for listening. We'll be back with more. If you're going to San Diego Comic Fest, I can announce the Legal Geeks will have two panels there. We'll talk Star Trek, and we'll talk Kaiju, and apparently on some other panels as well, like a Gene Roddenberry centennial panel. Looking forward to that. So I'll get to spend time with Kathy Steinman and Steve Chu again. So really looking forward to that.
Nice.
So anyway, everyone, stay safe, stay healthy, and stay geeky, and we'll see you soon.
Bye.